Good day and welcome to all the UK Column viewers and listeners wherever you are in the world. This is a very special interview today and one which I've looked forward to for quite a long time because the gentleman concerned, Dr. Michael Nels, MD, PhD, kindly sent me a copy of his book, The Indoctrinated Brain, which arrived just before Christmas. And I was absolutely fascinated to receive this. It had a very nice note in the front which said, "Dear Brian, thanks for your engagement." And I did start reading the book, and our objective was to get an interview set up. But a little bit of time went past, and so it's taken until now to get you with us here in the UK Column. So I'm going to call you Michael if you're happy with that. Mike, and welcome to the UK Column. It's a real pleasure to have you with us today.
Brian, the pleasure's all mine. And don't worry about the time. I mean, the book has a few pages, so 3 months is not such a long time.
It seemed that a lot of days had gone by, but yeah, the time goes pretty quickly. Now, for the audience, I think an important thing for me to do is to read out a little bit of Dr. Nels' CV, because this really gives a background and we can see his deep experience, and that gives us a good foundation for talking about what he's seeing in the world and also how he's come to write a very detailed book with a lot of accompanying footnotes. So let's have a look at this CV, if we may. It says that you're a physician and a molecular geneticist specializing in immunology. As a basic researcher, Michael has deciphered the genetic causes of dozens of hereditary diseases at German and international research institutions. Two of his discoveries were published in collaboration with two Nobel Prize winners. Another discovery of a key gene in immunity development was honored by the renowned American Association of Immunologists as a pillar of immunology for his pioneering findings on Alzheimer's disease development, prevention, and therapy. He was awarded the Hans Prize for Psychiatry by the Rostock University Hospital. Dr. Nels was vice president of the genome research at a US company for 3 years and a chief scientific officer and CEO of a Munich-based biotechnology company for 8 years. A scientific author, and he's written several bestsellers which have been translated into many languages. And you've also been a private lecturer. Michael, that's quite some CV. And you've been through all of that. And then at this particular time, you're prompted to write a very detailed book about what, in my mind, what you're describing is an attack on our minds. What got you thinking about the need for a book after all that professional experience?
Well, I actually wrote a couple of books about the deterioration of our mind. I'm talking about Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's was a disease I selected about 15 years ago as a disease that by dogma is regarded as caused by aging. And I was able to show that this dogma is wrong, and that actually our lifestyle causes Alzheimer's, and the aging is just a prerequisite because it takes time to develop the disease. So just because it takes some decades to develop the disease doesn't mean that the age by itself is the cause. And that's very important, because once you understand that your lifestyle is important, that your health, your mental health stays intact, then that changes everything. And so when I started to write books about this, and three or four of them became actually bestsellers, still I only reached about one per mil of all the people I wanted to reach, meaning 50% of all Germans at the time said that their primary fear is to develop Alzheimer's. And I went to the health insurance companies, I went to the mainstream media and tried to get this information out. And it was not just an idea of mine. I actually published it as a paper in 2016, Unified Theory of Alzheimer's Disease. And what I realized is that I got a lot of headwind, a lot of pressure against me from scientists which worked very closely with the pharmaceutical industry. And even the Alzheimer's societies didn't support my case. In quite contrary, they said lifestyle has nothing to do with Alzheimer's and only a drug can help us. So I experienced already that there was no interest in keeping the mental health of people intact. But in particular, you have to understand that Alzheimer's is just the tip of an iceberg of a development over decades where the mind is deteriorating. So it means people, even if they develop Alzheimer's with 60, 65, are not mentally healthy when they are 30 or 35. Actually, Alzheimer's process probably starts already in childhood. So the whole society is not mentally as fit, as capable as it could be. And that made me fear of what's about democracy? I mean, how do people vote? How can they be influenced if their mental capabilities, and particularly the area where Alzheimer's starts or autobiographical memory center, is also the seat of our mental immune system, as I was able to show. So if the mental immune system is down, that means people are easy to be manipulated, particularly by fear mongering. And when I realized what was going on in 2020 and 2021, at the time I was writing a book. It's not yet translated into English, but we're just contracting it out. It's called, in English translation, it's the predecessor of the indoctrinated brain, which you have on your table. It's the exhausted brain. And there I made the discovery that our ability to think depends also on this very center that is our autobiographical memory. So the center of our autobiographical memory is also the center of the mental energy we require for thinking. And that explained to me that people who are on the road to Alzheimer's don't have the mental energy to change their lifestyle. But it also told me, I was just finishing the book in summer 2020, that all the measures that are occurring against this so-called COVID pandemic essentially aggravated the situation, made it even more problematic. And I was able to show in my book that that people accepted all these nonsensical measures so easily, up to the point where they allowed others to inject an experimental gene therapy, and it's not even a gene therapy, it's a gene genetic program, essentially. I realized that all this was connected, but it took me a while to understand what the real goal is behind just making money.
Thank you very much for that. There's already so much there, because the Alzheimer story is fascinating. It's one that's interested me. And of course, yes, there is a fear amongst people about Alzheimer's, particularly as you get older, because we're seeing so many people who are succumbing to it. And the idea that you might then suffer from it yourself is something that plays on your mind. I think I've been lucky in my family. My father got to 94 and my mother was 85 when they passed. But both of them were completely fine in their mental capacity. And I found myself thinking sometimes, what is it that makes such a huge difference between people, who develop Alzheimer's at a very early age or relatively early age, and other people that seem to be able to live to great years and not have any problems at all. So I was thinking about that. And something else which caught my attention was David Cameron, who mentioned on one occasion that I think the figure he said, I may have the number wrong and I may have the date wrong, but he definitely was talking about 2 million, I think it was, people having Alzheimer's by a particular date, 2034 or something like this. And I was fascinated, one, as to why he would be talking about this, and two, how he could predict apparently so accurately into the future that was so many people would suffer from Alzheimer's. So I'd throw that in there. We're going to talk about other matters, but this was a fascinating subject for me at that time.
It's a good introduction into the topic we are going to talk about. But as I was telling you, in the unified theory of Alzheimer's disease, I was able to show that lifestyle is the cause. And lifestyle meaning, as the further you are away from what I would call a natural lifestyle in accordance to our natural needs, our genetics, our natural history. If the further we go away, the faster we develop Alzheimer's. And the proof of the pudding essentially was the COVID pandemic and the measures, particularly the measures, because just to give you some numbers, in 2018, the German Alzheimer's Society made a poll and an analysis study, and they found out that about 300,000 new cases of Alzheimer's were developed in 2018 in Germany. 300,000 new cases. We already have about 1.5 million cases, but it takes a few years before you die. So you have a constant, essentially, addition of new cases every year, and a certain number of people who essentially drop off the statistics. But the number is increasing, of course, because also people have a lifestyle that is more and more different from what should be natural. But then the measures came in 2020, and I already wrote in my book, The Exhausted Brain, we have to expect an increase in the cases of Alzheimer's, because these measures made people live a lifestyle that is so far away from natural, further than it was even before. And so when I looked at the numbers, there was another study from the German Alzheimer's Association in 2021. So they looked at the year 2021. And the increase we had from 2018 in numbers were 31%. 31% new cases, and you can believe me, German society didn't age by 31%. It was just the lifestyle that changed so dramatically from the measures in 2020, which were completely unnatural to humans, but also, as I was able to show, the spike protein that has been delivered in 2021 is an accelerator of Alzheimer's. The acceleration you can see also not only by the numbers, you can see it also by another statistical fact. So when I started medicine, the age of onset for Alzheimer's was like 65 years. And everything below 65 was regarded as most likely caused by a mutation in your genome. There are certain genes like presenilins. If they are mutated, they accelerate essentially the development of Alzheimer's. But they only accelerate it. They're not the cause. They accelerate it. If you live a normal, natural lifestyle, these genes wouldn't make any difference, most likely, as was shown in animal models. So if you put these mutated genes in a mouse, the mouse will develop Alzheimer's. But if you give the mouse the chance to live in an enriched environment, give it a little bicycle, and we call it a hamster circle or whatever. I don't know what the
hamster
word is.
A wheel.
A hamster wheel. They actually return to normal. Their brain starts to be normal again. They're actually more, even if they have these genes, these human genes transplanted into their genome, hamster wheel or an enriched environment is sufficient that these mice are more intelligent than other mice living under lab conditions having not this gene implanted. So we know that lifestyle beats genetics. So what happens now is these genetic causes are very rare. They are less than 1%, and they lead to an acceleration. So we have about 1% of all cases are below 65. And most of them have a mutation. But in 2021, we had 20% below 65. We had over 100,000 new cases of Alzheimer's below the age of 65, meaning we have a dramatic acceleration which cannot be explained by mutations because we don't have a 20-fold increase in mutations suddenly. That doesn't make any sense. It's, again, lifestyle leading to this accelerated deterioration of the mental abilities, and particularly the area, the hippocampus, which is by its anatomical shape declared as the hippocampus or named hippocampus, and it means it's the autobiographical memory center. And as I was able to show, this is the center of our brain that encompasses the mental immune system, which is not only our memory, but all several other features which are required that we actually can navigate through life without being harmed.
There are a number of key points that you've mentioned there, because you start doing research on Alzheimer and you come out with findings which seem to challenge what the established norm is that charities are using. And I think you said to us that when you pointed this out, you didn't get the reaction you expected from those other research organizations and the charities. So we take that one key point. This is very important. You as a very experienced professional in this field, come out with scientific findings which challenge the message which is being put out about Alzheimer's, and you're not welcomed in. You are what, held off? Did people talk to you at all about what you discovered?
It's not about the content. When they started to attack me, it's more against my person. It's not, they never challenged anything on the science, never. So for example, the first book I wrote in German, as a German book is called, in English would be called The Alzheimer's Lie. The lie is that people are lied about the real cause of Alzheimer's, and they are told it's aging. And if aging is the real cause, of course, then you don't have to change your lifestyle. So why would you change your lifestyle if it's just luck, pure luck, that your genetics work? For example, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, it's a very important Zeitung in Germany, a newspaper in Germany, Süddeutsche Zeitung. It's like the New York Times or so, very important in Germany, interviewed a prominent, maybe the most prominent Alzheimer's researcher on this planet, Dennis Selko from the United States. I actually met him personally. I had a conversation with him, invited me to Florida once, because my company in Germany and the company he was advising had the idea that we should work together on Alzheimer's, the technology I developed, and their interest to develop drugs. Anyway, so I met him and I know he is very excellent, but when he was asked by the Süddeutsche Zeitung, okay, Professor Selko, you are the expert in the world. What would you recommend people to prevent Alzheimer's? And he said two things. First, choose your right parents, so meaning genetics, yeah, which you can't, and die early.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what he said. And this is what I hear all the time. So for me, this is a big lie because it's essentially devastating, and it doesn't put people in the right mindset that they can do something personally about this. And it has devastating consequences also for our society, not only for individuals. But when my paper came out, and particularly the book came out, for example, one prominent researcher, the most prominent researcher we have in Germany, Christian Haas, he was honored very strongly by all societies, but of course they are all supported by pharmaceutical industry. Anyway, he, for example, wrote a review about my book, and in the review he writes, Dr. Nels is accusing all 1.4 million Alzheimer patients in Germany of lying.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. The Alzheimer's lie is that this is ridiculous, but if people don't know my book and read this from a prominent Alzheimer's researcher, they think Michael Nels is just a stupid idiot. Yeah. And I don't want to use another word. So he is just somebody making up things and is ridiculing Alzheimer's patients. Quite contrary. I want to give everybody hope that there is an alternative. And I can explain it very well.
Just to come back in there so that we're clear, the book that you're talking about in your dialogue about Alzheimer's is The Exhausted Brain. Is that correct?
Actually, all of my books touch on it, and even the new book that you have on your table, The Indoctrinated Brain, has a formula in there. It's the formula against indoctrination. And I can tell you the formula against indoctrination is exactly the formula against Alzheimer's in my other books. So it's just a continuing story, because the hippocampus as the center of, at the starting point, anatomical starting point of Alzheimer's, that's where the disease starts, is also important for chronic exhaustion. That's why it's the exhausted brain, where I show how lifestyle has to be changed, that we are not chronically exhausted. And in the indoctrinated brain, I also show that that if we don't develop the full capacity that our nature allows us regarding the hippocampal growth, if this hippocampus is shrinking instead of growing, which is its potential, then our complete mental immune system collapses. So it's always the same story. If you, let's put it this way, if you want to fight indoctrination by having a more alert mental immune system, you're also fighting Alzheimer's.
Let's just bring your book on screen so that people can see it. Really excellent book, huge amount of information in there. So I've actually read it and then gone back into it, because I've had to go back into sections to remind myself what you were talking about. So that's it, The Indoctrinated Brain. And as I've said to the audience already, there's a huge number of references which are all catalogued in the back of the book. We're going to talk about your book, The Indoctrinated Brain, but you were prompted to write that book as a result of experiences with Alzheimer, but also you're particularly coming back to essentially COVID-19 and the lockdown period. That clearly had a huge impact on you and I think stimulated you to get on with this latest book. So As the COVID-19, I'm wanting to choose my words carefully there, because scamdemic is used, but it's not awfully popular. Let's just say, as the COVID-19 rules and regulations came into being, whether it was in Germany or UK, this was a major change in our lifestyle, and people were put under a lot of pressure. You were experiencing that lockdown. What is it that really triggered you to start looking into what was happening around COVID-19 and the policies?
Yeah, first of all, as you already alluded to in the introduction, I did my PhD work in molecular genetics on discovering a gene that is responsible for our adaptive immune system. So prior to working on Alzheimer's, which actually is the consequence of neuroinflammation, so there's a strong connection between inflammation, chronic inflammation, and Alzheimer's. So there's a connection between our immune system, our physical immune system, and also our mental immune system. It's a very strong intricate connection there. So I knew what is required for our immune system to function well. And it was clear for over many decades that the seasonality of respiratory diseases depends on the lack on vitamin D in the winter months. In the winter time, also in early spring when we measure the lowest vitamin D levels in modern societies, in northern societies, of course, not in Africa. And so it was totally clear that, first of all, the likelihood of getting infected and spreading an infection requires a vitamin D deficiency. Also, the severe consequences of a respiratory disease, infection with the virus, doesn't matter what kind of virus it is, was shown years ago that it's causing under vitamin D deficiency what we call an inflammatory response, a hyperinflammatory response, or what is officially known as the cytokine storm. So the cytokine storm is actually killing you. So when you ask what is deadly about the virus, the question is the virus actually deadly Or is it rather the deficiency in vitamin D? I would rather say the vitamin D deficiency is causing the deadly outcomes. And so that was not only my opinion. It's based on a lot of scientific evidence, but also, for example, and Professor Cistina from the University of Milan, I guess, in Italy, I think it's Milan. He already mentioned in spring 2020 that all the deaths that we see in northern Italy at the time, because it was the first cases reported in Europe, are actually and most likely based on a lack of vitamin D in the elderly population. And in many papers came out in 2020, which showed that, for example, the likelihood of dying of COVID is 18 times higher if you are vitamin D level is below 30 nanomole per liter. So compared to above 30 nanomole per liter, which led the German Cancer Research Center, where I actually worked for over a year once, the specialist there published a paper that in peer review that 9 of 10 deaths of COVID can be prevented by just increasing the vitamin D level in the population. But pretty much like with Alzheimer's, what was my experience, that there is no interest in really helping people in this health system, which is actually a sickness system, in my opinion. Quite contrary to actually telling people, okay, take vitamin D, take sufficient vitamin D. And we know now in 2021, another meta study came out, which combined many different studies on vitamin D and COVID, showed that at a level of 125 nanomole per liter, which is 4 times higher than the average in Germany in winter time, at 125 nanomole per liter, the likelihood of dying of COVID is actually zero. So this was all known. And still, instead of promoting vitamin D, there was a huge propaganda against vitamin D. And that made me really suspicious. I mean, there was something going on. It was almost like people had to die for some purpose. Well, what was the purpose? Is it just that you get this injection program with the this genetic program running, that everybody accepts it because they fear people are actually dying of COVID? I mean, they pushed the numbers up. I knew already that from because of the PCR that was done. I mean, even Drosten, you know, the Professor Drosten who created this particular PCR test, mentioned years before that a single copy of a dead virus is sufficient with these high numbers of PCR cycles to have a positive test. And that's not even regarding the false tests based on a cross-reactivity of the primers in this test. Just to give you a background, I developed at least 10,000 tests in my life, you know, for genetic studies. So it's not something special. It's very easy. But I know you have to be very careful that you don't have cross-reactivity if you want to really measure something. Anyway, so the numbers were pushed high. People still had to die from respiratory disease. Of course, we don't know if somebody has a positive PCR and is dying from an infection of the lungs, if it was really, you know, COVID at the end because of the cross-reactivity of the PCR test. It could be any virus causing a respiratory disease doing that. But nevertheless, they were able to show, okay, the governments essentially didn't efficiently help to save people's life. And this is now the agenda of the WHO, that this disaster, this inability of the local government, of the national governments to save people is now the main major reason why the WHO is now being put into a position where they become a world controller with no checks and balances. So if I look at kind of a cascade of events, or then there is the lack of vitamin D, then there are a few real COVID deaths, then there is the mRNA program, which didn't prevent the likelihood of dying, but caused other harm. And now actually the same argument is used to that people were dying of COVID, which they shouldn't have, based on the understanding how vitamin D would have prevented it. And then now the same argument is used to put the WHO into world leadership. And this is ingenious, but it also needs the acceptance of people. And here comes the mental immune system in play. So it's not only about the respiratory disease and the physical immune system, what I was able to show, that people accept this dramatic change in how we are governed, that we essentially abandon democracy. All these things that are happening to us, which some productronists, activists in this area, published books about it, you know, like Schwab, for example, when he says COVID-19 and the Great Reset, or another protagonist like Prince Charles at the time, who actually coined the term, as far as I know, he coined the term Great Reset, and actually published publicly said in, I think it was June 2020, that we should use COVID-19 as a great or golden opportunity to change everything. What they want to change actually is to install a new operating system on society. In my book, I call it the social operating system, because it affects how we interact with each other and how our social life will be changed. So SOS is the abbreviation. I think it's acceptable. I think if you look at this, it's appropriate if you look at what's going on with us. But first, before you actually install such a new operating system on society, you have to, like in a computer, you have to change the hard drive somehow. You have to reformat the hard drive to erase all prior memory of how we were living together before that, and my book describes how this is accomplished, and that's really worrisome.
This brings us absolutely onto your book. Now, I sat down initially with your book and a cup of coffee, and I started to read it. A lot of detail. I then found that I broke away and I actually went to the main chapter headings to sort of get a feel for how you were approaching this huge subject. And then I went back to reading the book again. But that was a useful thing for me to do, because I ended up making some notes on the chapters and things which particularly caught my attention. So I wonder whether we could focus in on your book, and I'll give you a few words. You tell me whether I'm seeing things correctly. But to me, you'd looked at issues of people's health and lifestyle. That was there. And you come on to that subject later in the book in a positive way, what we can do. But you were particularly looking at the COVID-19 lockdown and the policies and the effects that they had on people's minds. So in one sense, you can look at what was happening through, we were being brainwashed, that we were being told what we could and could not do. But we were also being affected in a psychological way, because being locked down, as just one example, was having a bad effect on our mental health. And I know in one of the chapters you linked in the suffering of people who were being locked down at that time. You linked it in to mention of the Biderman characteristics, which I think came out of the UN or was attached to the UN originally, where they were describing methods to torture people by using applied psychology to damage their mental health, to make them depressed or anxious. So you covered that in the book, but you've also got this undertone of very detailed medical and genomic knowledge, which is your specialization, where you're saying these people aren't just playing around with policies, they're actually playing around with very fundamental aspects of our health. And you mention you've talked about the cytokine storm, but you also talk in the book about the spiked proteins. So this is a very broad coverage of subject areas which you've brought together in a dialogue, saying we really need to pay attention, because we'll say the people in control are attacking us in lots of different ways. They're attacking us via our lifestyle and our health. They're attacking our minds by what they were doing, particularly by lockdown. But there's also propaganda being used. And you've then taken that through to say, well, really, who are the people doing this and what do they want to achieve? So having said that to you, if I can just give our viewers the first three chapters. So chapter one, you're straight into it because you're talking about the Great Reset and the Brave New World. And chapter two is individuality, creativity, and the ability to think for oneself. So that was very much taking a look at us as individuals and getting people to understand more about who they are and how they should be working. And then chapter three is reprogramming the human brain, where very quickly you use an example that it's almost like our souls are being stripped out from us. So I was just fascinated that in your book, you came straight into identifying the Great Reset as being a key part of the problems. But could you just take us through a little bit about how you were developing your thoughts and your arguments in those first three chapters?
I mentioned already Alzheimer's, and Alzheimer's is developing because the hippocampus, that's our autobiographical memory center, our diary of our life, where we record everything that we are thinking, feeling, what we experience, stories we are told, all the narratives too. I want to maybe mention before I answer more detailed, narratives are nothing bad by per se. They have now a negative taste, because narratives are a word that has not been used much maybe a few years ago, but now we hear it all the time, and the narratives are what we are told, how we are manipulated, and so forth. But narratives, that's what our brain is dying for. I mean, we live from learning from our ancestors, from our grandparents, from our parents. Before the invention of Wikipedia and Google, we actually had to ask our elders for advice. And of course, in former times, Alzheimer's was almost not present, and the elders actually had the mind to tell us. So this diary of our life, the hippocampus, is the only area in our brain that can instantaneously remember everything. So if we think about something, these thoughts are only brainwaves. They are not recorded. So if our attention focuses to something else, every thought, every even brilliant thought that we might have occurred a few minutes ago is lost. We need the hippocampus to remember in each individual thought that we have. So without the hippocampus, we would not be able to think, not to plan our future, not to remember our past. So that's important. Second, the hippocampus itself can only do that in the long term if it produces new nerve cells all the time, because when we are born, we don't know how big our diary has to be. I mean, if you live like 122 years, like the oldest woman was ever alive, and you essentially need a new page to write on every day in your diary, this becomes a really huge book. So the hippocampus actually has the ability to grow with our wealth of experience. And the neurons that are produced every day, up to the highest age, that's the only area of the brain that can produce new nerve cells every day. This area of the hippocampus is in the entry part, produces these nerve cells, and these nerve cells give us a sense of space and time. They're actually called space and time neurons. But they're also required to retrieve previous memories. And that's why I call them in the book index neurons. Because these index neurons are the key to understand everything that I'm writing about. Index neurons need to be produced, otherwise we don't have new pages to write something on. So if you destroy the production side of these new neurons, if you inhibit their production, and this can be done by a lifestyle that is not natural, or it can be done, as I show, by the spike protein causing neuroinflammation neuroinflammation is the most efficient way to stop the production of these index neurons, then the question is, how does your brain function after that? How does it work if you don't have new index neurons for new memories? That means you have to override the previous ones. If you look at the metaphor of the diary, that means you have to write on the same page again that you have written something before. So the new narratives override previous narratives. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about you essentially remove your personal history and replace it by stories that are prominent to you at the time. And the most prominent stories that we're hearing at the time is that the world is in jeopardy. Yeah, the climate change will kill us all. Perma pandemics will kill us all. Wars, national wars, international wars might start a third world war, which would kill us all. And the only help that we can have, the only way out of all these global attacks on us and dangers is a global government. So, and this global government can only rule us and make sure that everything is safe and happy by most likely injecting us chips, supervising us, telling us how we have to live. Climate change will dictate, and there are actually governmental documents out there in German government agencies. We can see that they plan for 2030. That's the key year where all the development goals are heading to. In 2030, we are in a post-democratic society. We don't need democracy anymore. Artificial intelligence will know what is good for us. Of course, the artificial intelligence will follow the guidelines of the technocrats that install these systems and so forth. And this is all happening. So what we have to understand is if we stop the production of these index neurons by all these measures that we have experienced, and this was already happening decades before, we already are kind of educated to live an unhealthy lifestyle, and we are educated, doesn't matter how you live because you can't change anything in your brain. It has no effect on your brain. It's only age. It's the same story again. But at the end of the day, we can ignore, as I always say, we can ignore the natural necessities of our brain, but we cannot ignore the consequences that this ignorance will have on us.
I'll just come back on chapter 3, which was the one reprogramming the human brain. Very quickly, you're talking about fear. So you know, you've taken us through essential things to do with health and the state of our minds as a result of our health. But you particularly pick up on fear. And you said COVID fear is designed to create a new operating system. And you actually mentioned Huxley in A Brave New World. And you're talking about the hippocampus and anxiety for control. You're talking about creating anxiety in people. And then they are becoming slaves of what you call technocratic thinking. So this is a very powerful area, which I think a lot of people can start to think back, because so many people were frightened and anxious during the COVID period. I've seen it in some family members that they became really anxious, and I've known people who were actually would say, "I don't want to die." They were so frightened of what they were being told that obviously in their minds, they were thinking about their own death. So fear, if I've got this correct from what you've written, you regard fear as being a key tool of affecting the state of the brain.
Absolutely. Fear is the key to understand what was going on. And for several reasons. First of all, the index neurons, which I just described, have not only the function of indexing all our memories to give every memory a time and a space in our history, That's also important actually for future planning. If you want to plan something, these index neurons record the space and the time of the events that we want to maybe pursue in the future. But these index neurons have additional functions. They are shown to be the neuronal correlate of curiosity. And the other side of the coin of curiosity is what they also are the neuronal correlate is the psychological resilience. That means if you have a breakdown of the production of these new nerve cells, you also have a breakdown of your psychological resilience. Meaning whatever you experience, particularly when it makes you frightened, whatever you experience, you regard it as more frightening as it should be. You don't step back and you are not being curious and say, okay, this is a frightening information, but at the end of the day, let's put it in perspective. Based on my experience, based on what other people might say, I start to question it. I'm curious. But to be curious, you have to have psychological resilience because you have to be interested in new ideas, new thinking. And of course, new ideas, new thinking might you might not want to hear what you're going to hear. So people who have a low psychological resilience, they are not open for new thoughts. They are not open for alternative views. And so the mainstream media and propaganda was able to essentially completely infiltrate these people. They were not open to ask alternative questions. So the frame of mind of our society was that a large proportion of the person of people in our society, coming back to Alzheimer's as being only the tip of the iceberg, the index neuron production is down in our society based on decades of lifestyle that is not healthy. So the mental immune system was already down. So just I mentioned mental immune system several times. Mental immune system is the combination of curiosity, psychological resilience, mental energy to think, and our memories, our experience. And all these four things together comprise, for me, the mental immune system. And they all are related to the production of these new nerve cells. So that's the one part. The other part is the hippocampus selects what he wants to remember. So he has to select somehow because he's not very big. He's only the size of a thumb, a few cubic centimeters in our brain. He has not a storage capacity that can store everything that we experience during the day. So he has a selection criteria. The selection criteria is easy to understand from an evolutionary point of view. It has to be important. It has to be important for our life. Important for our life is, when you go back to hunter and gatherer societies, if you go out of the cave and you walk around, you either find food, it gives you a positive emotion, or you find an enemy, which gives you a negative emotion. It gives you fear. Both emotions, good or bad ones, lead to an enhanced memorization. And that's the selection criteria. So it has to, everything that we learn, experience, has to come with an emotion in order to be inscribed into the hippocampus.
Am I right in saying then the use of fear, and for us in UK, it was very obvious the government was using fear during COVID because as part of the SAGE, the scientific advisory team, they had a psychological team, Spy B, and minutes were released. Well, we helped release those minutes in which what they were saying that they needed more anxiety in the population to enforce control of the regulations. We need more anxiety. We need people effectively to be more fearful. So as you become fearful, two things are happening. One is that you're shutting down in a psychological sense, so you're shutting down, but also your memories are becoming selective to the item that's created the fear. Would that be correct?
Exactly. So the first thing that you're describing is people become depressed. And actually, we had the highest rate of depression ever recorded in 2018-2019. That's published and peer-reviewed in many places. But I saw a paper in fall 2020, for the first half year of the COVID measures, and the it was published from a study in the United States. And from this high level of depression, we had a threefold increase in the first half year. So the fear mongering took its toll, besides all the measures, which not being outside, not being able to socialize with people. These are all important factors in my formula against indoctrination, because when we engage in this natural way of behaving and being in contact to other people, it's like a fertilizer for our brain. It increases the production of index neurons. But if you are not doing that, then the production goes down, and we are already in a state with low psychological resilience. Then comes the fear, and we actually develop what I call neuroinflammation. Neurons are overheating, so to speak. They release molecules which we call danger-associated molecular patterns, or DAMPs, as an acronym. And the DAMPs are recognized by immune cells in the brain by a receptor called TLR4. And once this receptor recognizes that brain cells are endangered or are under a lot of stress, then they start the production of pro-inflammatory cytokines, and they shut down the hippocampus further. Then comes the second part that you are describing. The story that you are told under fear, of course, the hippocampus has to learn them, that he will remember them. We remember them because our life is at stake, based on the narratives. So we will remember them, but we have no new index neurons to do that. And then it starts to override previously existing memories. We might forget events on a birthday we had a year ago or 2 years ago. We might forget memories of our childhood because the index neurons responsible for these memories are going to be overwritten.
Right.
And that's really, really devastating if you think about that, what's really happening here. And right. But it's in line of what I'm saying.
Sorry to interject there. Yeah. So we had the situation during COVID that governments, because this was happening in UK, Germany, Europe, everywhere. It was happening worldwide, governments were imposing these very draconian lockdown policies on people, which was raising anxiety. They were also changing the rules and regulations, so there was uncertainty coming in as well, anxiety and uncertainty, which I believe are a powerful combination.
Brian, just what you mentioned here, that was the most mind-boggling thing actually you just mentioned. I would maybe just comment for a minute on this point you made, the changing regulations. You see, at one point you say it happened everywhere in the world, so it was well orchestrated. And we know that it was all well planned. The plans were published years before. Event 209 and 201 and others showed us what needs to happen in case of. But then there was this change in regulations, like they were not knowing what they were doing. So at the one time you had this major plan acting worldwide, but locally, every nation experienced this situation where you felt they don't know what they are doing. And you had this change in regulations almost on a daily basis. But if you go back on my thesis that the index neurons need to be overwritten, then it suddenly makes sense. And it's the only explanation that I have that makes sense, because you need to change the stories. The hippocampus only learns things when they are new. Repetitive information, even if they cause anxiety, if they are repetitively delivered, the hippocampus doesn't use new index neurons. He says, okay, it's 2 times, 3 times, 5 times, 10 times, always the same story. These stories become routine, and the hippocampus is not counting them every time. So only if you change the story, new index neurons will be overwritten. So you have a more dramatic effect on overriding pre-existing memories if you change the story.
Right.
So this changing of the story might be part of the master plan. That's what I'm suggesting.
Okay. Thank you for that. So chapter 4, which you call Master Plan. Chapter 4 and Chapter 5 you call Master Plan, and then Chapter 4 is Part 1, which you entitle Destruction of the Autobiographical Memory. And again, fear, you're talking fear eating the soul. But you start talking about, also start talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. And this little sentence really caught my eye, because you say, and you were very surprised to find that Bill and Melinda Gates were actually researching PTSD. And why would they want to do that? And you also bring in children at this point, that children's minds are also being attacked by fear. And you, in this particular chapter, you have a diagram of fear causation, so people can see a diagram that you've produced in the chapter. So the master plan being unleashed against us by chapter 4 of the book, you are very clear that this is orchestrated and our memories are being attacked by a number of techniques. And now individuals and organizations are starting to appear. Can you tell us a bit more about what you found around post-traumatic stress when you started to look at Bill and Melinda Gates?
Yeah, I mean, post-traumatic stress, I was really surprised why somebody who was investigating mainly vaccination programs, supporting research in this area, is also supporting research in post-traumatic stress syndrome. And it even goes a step further. They're not only starting to analyze post-traumatic stress syndrome, they're also invested in pre-traumatic stress syndrome. So it's also PTBS. It has the same abbreviation, but it's pre-traumatic. And they were actually able to show that you don't have to experience physically a trauma. You don't have to witness a trauma that causes post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's simply enough to narrate the fear on such a traumatic, potential traumatic event to cause the same effect. And the same effect is a shrinkage of the hippocampus. So the hallmark of post-traumatic stress syndrome, if you check the brain by MRI, for example, magnetic resonance imaging, is the hallmark is a shrunken hippocampus. So it's essentially a highway to Alzheimer's in the long run, and of course, a severe depression. But it can cause this development by just putting people into the imagination of a trauma. Though dying, for example, from a respiratory disease, or causing such a disease on your grandparents if you are a child. So these events, these narratives, cause a lot of harm, because there is apparently not much of a difference between post-traumatic stress syndrome and pre-traumatic stress syndrome.
This is very serious. This is very serious stuff, which is coming out of government, largely coming out of government policy, whether or not it's got a component of policy coming from the World Health Organization. But for the average man and woman on the street, these are our governments and the World Health Organization supposed to be there to protect us. And you're identifying that actually the policies that were coming in to protect us during the COVID pandemic were severely damaging us. In fact, you're taking it a step further, because you're saying this has to be orchestrated. This can't be an accidental formulation of policy to do this.
No, it was certainly not accidental. I mean, the evidence is coming out now from all different areas. For example, the German CDC, Cancer of Disease Control, Center of Disease Control, it's called Robert Koch Institute, RKI. They just released documents, of course, severely blackened. But still, if you look whatever is left there, it's clear that all the measures, the policies in 2020 were not done because of a health crisis. They were done because apparently some agent that is closely related to the war industry, I would say, had an interest that the measures were taken and pushed forward and promoted. And it's clear this war against COVID is essentially a war against humans, and in particular, the human mind.
Chapter 5, if we go on, which is Master Plan as well, but part 2, it's Master Plan part 2, Confession to the Technocratic Faith. So at this point, you are starting to develop your analysis and your ideas, in that all of these things have been done to us, but they've been done to us for a reason, that essentially our minds are being captured, and a new operating system's coming in, which is their agenda. So if I just give a couple of things which maybe help remind you of what you wrote at the time. You talked about the susceptibility of children to the environment and ideas. So you're picking up very strongly on how children are very vulnerable to the techniques being used. You also mentioned George Orwell very early on in that chapter, talking about the need to get people to believe what the party is talking about, 2 + 2 = 5. And you're talking about COVID contradictions between narrative and perceptions. Between narrative and perceptions. And you're also talking about a mental reset of the population. And here you start talking about communist indoctrination techniques. And this is the point at which you talk about the Biderman system. So if I've got this right, particularly in the Korean War, the Chinese started to use techniques on the American prisoners of war, which people hadn't seen before. Brutality and torture had been used, of course, in many conflict environments. But the Chinese in the Korean War started to do something different, which is they placed the American prisoners, in quite comfortable conditions, but they then proceeded to manipulate and play with their belief systems. And so you've now gone a long way from just talking about the attack on people's minds, the development of children. You're coming right up against some very sinister psychological techniques to install this new belief system in the public.
It's actually an 8-point program that Biderman and some other co-workers developed or identified. I think it was 1956 when they published it. Peer-reviewed all the papers on what they discovered from those prisoners of war that actually returned to the United States. And they were, of course, then severely interrogated and asked, what happened to you? How did the Chinese do that to you? Because they were quite surprised at the end of the war that not all the prisoners wanted to return to the United States. Some actually started to really believe that communism is better. And that was particularly interesting because people were sent as soldiers into a war, fighting for the Western ideals, and they must strongly believe in those ideas, otherwise they wouldn't fight for them. And then they were reverted and actually confessed to communist ideas. So that was really interesting. And and the 8-point program, I checked it out, and everything that was in this program was actually done to us as the world population. And there was actually an interim, as I was able to find out, in Guantanamo Bay. The people were educated there to essentially use this 8-point program, the Biderman program, as it is called, on the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. So they had essentially created a lot of experience how to apply that to people in the Western world. And so I think it was kind of a logical next step, if you really want to change the mindset of people, to apply the same knowledge on humans in the whole world.
Okay, so that takes us to the point really of who is doing this. So as COVID unfolded, most people will be looking to the government in their respective countries as the source of the policy that they were experiencing. But of course, we now know, particularly with hindsight, that we see the immense power of the United Nations and the World Health Organization. But we've also got to bring in the likes of the World Economic Forum, who were clearly pushing and driving this policy, which was global. It wasn't just happening within one or two nation states. It was happening as a shared policy throughout the world. So where is your analysis taking you with respect to who is causing the problem, who is attacking us?
Well, I mean, we know the players because they are openly talking about this, which I find interesting and frightening at the same time, because it's not a conspiracy anymore. I mean, come on, they are just, they write books about it. They talk openly about what they want to achieve. So it's so we cannot say, hey, we didn't know. They exactly tell us what they want to achieve and how they want to achieve it. They clearly show what the path is. And they know that the COVID and the COVID measures are helping in their idea of creating a new world order in a way. Yeah, it's a new it's not a great reset like a reset button on your computer where you go back maybe a few decades and start all over again. It's a new operating system on society, and they also clearly show what they expect from, for example, that 90% of the society is a useless class, as they tell us. So that's one point, but we don't know who's really behind it. I mean, these are the players that we see. There might be others behind it, but then it becomes conspiracy. I don't know. I can't tell. There might be even stronger people behind that. On the other side, the people we are talking about belong to the most influential, the richest people on our earth. And so I don't have to go beyond that maybe, and I see them. But who knows? I can't tell. But I also want to make clear at that point, this is about, I'm a scientist, so I bring together only the evidence that I can pull from all different sources, from published papers to published papers, scientific papers, I mean, but also published documents from our governments and other governments worldwide. And if you put all this together, you create a case like a prosecutor. Of course, the prosecutor, that's me in that case, a scientific prosecutor, has to believe in its case. But it doesn't mean that I'm right, though we need a jury. And the jury will be my reader, so everybody can decide for her or himself if I might be correct or might be not correct. But to be perfectly honest, at the end of the day, it doesn't make a difference. Even if I'm wrong, what's happening is happening. So even if there's nobody behind it, it's all a great conspiracy, is only a great coincidence. It doesn't make a difference because the mental immunity system of humans is declining, and we are forced to live in a life in the future that we all don't want. You just have to look at the contract that is now going to be to be put in place with the World Health Organization, which gives complete control of our health system. It's clear where we are heading, and we have to fight against that as efficiently as we can.
That makes complete sense. And as you were talking through that, my mind went back to chapter 5, where one of the things that I picked out is this is, I think, against the backdrop of the prisoners in Korea that you've just talked about. But you were talking about isolation, monotony and fear creating a thought loop where people's thoughts are just going around in this small little bubble and they're not really able to think outside that. Now, that to me is a very dangerous state, because if you're in a loop of thoughts, you're not processing the wider world around you. So that's a big problem. And if you're not processing the wider world around you, you're not being curious, which is doing damage to the neuron level in your brain, which you've taken us through. But this is where people are at the moment. So even if it's a coincidence, what is happening to us, somehow we've got to be working with people to break them out of this bubble or thought loop.
Absolutely. We have to get out of this devil's cycle, so to speak, which is also a devil's cycle of neuroinflammation, which is kind of the neuronal correlate of what you're describing, that we are in this constant fear and brain fog and all these inabilities that don't allow us to see the picture clearly that's unfolding in front of us. And so so we need to find a way out. And this is where the last chapter is focusing about in my book, how to save ourselves from the SOS, save our souls from this operating system that's going to be installed on us. And I have several suggestions how to do that in my book. First of all, you have the formula against indoctrination. So everybody who's listening to us right now, I guess, has still a functioning mental immune system. Otherwise, he wouldn't tolerate what we are talking about, wouldn't accept it. Fear would be too high. And of course, people who are watching us are open-minded. So for them, I would say they have a functioning mental immune system just from the clinical observation that they are watching us. So these, and what I always say is once you have a functioning mental immune system, you also have a responsibility. You have the responsibility not only to watch us and to maybe make sure that your own life somehow goes through this changes in our world. I see that actually in my family, that people say, okay, I understand what you're saying, but I don't care about what's happening outside. I just make sure that I have enough food in my basement, that I have my own power supply and whatever, you know. But at the end of the day, you cannot survive that isolated. We have to fight as humanity against that. We have to save humanity against that. And so I feel that everybody who understands what's going on has a responsibility to support the common goal of humanity to stay actually human. And so everybody who's watching us, and I guess this would reflect about 20-25% of the human population at the moment, are still open-minded. They understand what's going on or are willing to understand what's going on. And pretty much, well, if you, let's say, fly on a plane, the flight attendants tell you, in case of an emergency, oxygen is lacking, the face mask, put it on yourself, and then help others. And that's exactly what I'm suggesting. First of all, make sure that your mental immune system stays strong. There are maybe a couple of things that I outline in my book you can make to make it even stronger. And in addition to that, once you have done that, you can start helping others. Because at the moment, I don't think the other 70-75% who underwent, for example, the mRNA program, injection program, as kind of a confession that you alluded to in chapter 5, that you accept something which you wouldn't accept under healthy conditions, healthy mental conditions. Well, these 70%, they are not there anymore. It's maybe only a few percent. There are a large proportion of those who understand that there's really something wrong going on. They might not have the mindset to really go into it, but they might be open enough that the other 20-25% with the strong mental immune system can start to convince them that they what's going on, and tell them the background of what's going on, and start fighting against that. We have to get back to a democracy, a real democracy, with people with healthy brains, go on the street and fight against what's going on.
Michael, thank you for that. Just one thing, again, that comes into my mind from what you wrote in that final chapter, and it really stuck with me. You said we need to look at the concept that actually people are good. They are capable of good and productive things, because we live in a world where we're bombarded by media, which tells us that actually we're bad, we're trouble, we're stupid, we're incompetent, we're a problem for the state. So I thought that was a very positive approach, that people look at themselves and they see something positive in themselves as a start.
Yeah, I was really inspired by the Dutch historian Rutger Bregman, who wrote a book, Humankind, where he investigated over the last decades what we believe the narrative about the human nature. And the narrative about the human nature, as you already alluded to, is that we are basically bad, evil, and we need all these rules to behave. But he actually showed very clearly in his book that the opposite is the case. But of course, there's some kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. If we believe that we are bad, if we believe that others are bad, of course, not ourselves, of course, we are the good guys, but everybody else is bad, we have a complete wrong picture of human society, and that shapes our behavior. So we have to change our view about ourselves. We have an understanding of about ourselves. And I was taking a lot of his book and showed what for me were the eye openers, and put it together in short notes from his book, to make sure that also people read his book, not only mine, but because it's really worth reading it. But of course, it's important that this information is also in my book, because it helped me to understand what might be the way out of this problem that we have now.
And you talked about the fact that in the media around us, we just get reflected back all the badness and all of the strife and anxiety and troubles and killings, whatever it is. That's what we are bombarded with. We're not surrounded by a media which is putting out all the good works of people where they have been kind and looked after their fellow men and women. So you identify this contrast with where we should be, with what's echoed back at us. You cover that very strongly. Michael, there are so many questions I'd like to ask you, but I'd like to say, would you come back again? Because there's much more to talk about as far as I'm concerned. And I'm very, very sure that the UK Column viewers and listeners would like to hear more of any direction that you want to go in. So I'm going to ask you that first.
We could certainly do that. We didn't cover, for example, lithium as an essential trace element, which I think deserves another discussion. It's very important. So I invite everybody who listens to us right now to maybe go on my website. You find info on how lithium, a trace element, can essentially intercept the neuroinflammatory cycle of in our brain that causes depression, Alzheimer's, and brain fog. It's very important that people understand that. It's one of my biggest fights that I have right now, to show the world leaders and the regulators, that lithium, low dose lithium, as microdosed lithium, is essential for humans' lives and the human mental immune system. I was actually able to talk about this in front of about 1,500 globalists and NGO representatives just recently. I was invited by, I just want to mention this briefly because I think it's important, and also important maybe for others to listen to my speech. I was invited by the foreign minister of Switzerland to give a talk at the IC conference. It's the International Cooperation Conference held in Basel just a few weeks ago on 11th and 12th of April, 2024. And for whatever reason, they invited me to give a keynote speech about what the brain needs to think peace. And that was just a week after I gave an interview to Tucker Carlson. And now I was in front of the people who advocate, many of them advocated the policies and the mRNA injection program. And I was able to show this very important audience that everything could have been prevented by just giving enough vitamin D to the people. I was also able to show that the spike protein is neurotoxic, causing havoc on the mental immune system. But I was also able to show that lithium in an essential dose is essentially helping to abolish this this process, this mentally havocing process. So if you might, you want to maybe put the link on my speech on the bottom. I gave it in English. And I think it's very important that the whole world knows about what I was able to show this distinguished audience.
That's exceptionally positive, and that's a great segue into a part two, because I was going to end this this interview by saying to you, what can people do in order to look after their mental health and their physical health? We'll save that for part two, because I think people are going to be really enthusiastic to discover how they can look after themselves more. And I'm sitting here thinking, yes, I should be happy to learn anything about staving off Alzheimer's. So that would be a very good thing. And of course, we'll put up details of your website. I'll hold your book up once again, because I think this is really key. People should be purchasing this. And it's a book which is going to take some brain power to read, because I found I had to work through it very carefully, because there's so much detail. So presumably your own book is a good stimulus for our minds.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Michael, thank you very much for joining us. It's been absolutely fascinating. As I said, I've got many more questions. We'll save those for part two. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Brian, thank you very much for inviting me. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Okay. Thank you.